Now, this is the second session of an interview with Derek Kendrick for the University of Adelaide School of Architecture History on the 9th of July 2008, interviewer Rob Lynn. Derek, you've spoken very clearly about the Jensen era and then the switch to David Saunders and how you were all startled by moving from a five-year, very structured degree to a 3+2 and how David backed off a bit and did a 2+3 as well.
Yeah, it was a 3+3.
3+3.
Yeah. With the second year, first degree transfer, yeah.
How did that work out over time, that new degree, the new degree?
The further aspect of David Saunders' course that really worried the daylights out of us was, for want of a better word, was the side entry. And that is that you didn't have to come through the first 3 years of the Bachelor of Architectural Studies degree to get into the second degree of Bachelor of Architecture. You could actually come in with any degree and undertake, I forget what they call it, a qualifying year, whereby we would look at your first degree knowledge, design a particular set of courses that you needed to take to augment your first degree, and that would then give you a graduate diploma. This is in the days before graduate diplomas, and you could then come into the course. And we didn't like that at all. But in honesty again, this was another wonderful idea of David Saunders. Can you imagine a student with a degree in dentistry becoming an architect? Can you imagine somebody with a degree in German becoming an architect? Can you imagine somebody with a degree in music becoming an architect? Those are the degrees that were presented and accepted and moved into the professional architecture course after having done the qualifying year for their particular cases, and many of them turned out to be the most wonderful students the school has ever had. The fellow with a degree in music has subsequently shown himself to be quite outstanding, winning RAIA prizes for energy conservative architecture. Now, these deliberate changes by these few students that came in this special side entry, they've all turned out to be rather special. One of the things that David Saunders did was to find $10,000 to pay for a psychologist to look into motivation, why people should come into the architecture course. And he, this psychologist, I think his name was White, carried out interviews with students and prepared reports. I think the hope was that we would come out with some kind of formula that would guide us into how we could select students for the first degree course, and then later how we could select students more for the second degree course, the professional architecture course. But the research that was done didn't get us very far down the track. I think the strongest piece of evidence was the degree of motivation that the student had to want to do it. That was why they succeeded. There wasn't any other academic grounding that could be found, which I thought was an interesting finding, even though we thought it was negative for where we wanted to go from the point of view of selecting students into the course. Because at this stage, we are trying to select 24 students for the professional degree course. But we have had an intake of 30, 40, 45, 50, 70 into the first degree, and the bottleneck is getting narrower. And how do you get into the second degree? Well, it's the top 24 plus your side entry of 5 or whatever it was, making 30. And so you had the terrible job of telling students who had done the first degree, sorry, but you're not good enough to go on to the second degree. We don't have places for you. Then we realized that this was bad tactically. Students from Asia, for example, wouldn't come to Adelaide unless there was a guarantee that they could continue from the first degree into the second degree to get their architecture degree, which they wanted. They were vocationally directed. They didn't give a damn about what the course was. They didn't see the academic first degree as having merit. They just wanted to be a practicing architect. They were looking for a job. And so there was pressure from that. But then there was also pressure from the Institute of Architects. As part of the original setup of the two-degree structure, in order to make room to do more of the studio work and design work, David Saunders decided to throw out all the professional practice work. And things like specifications, bills of quantities, office management, all the stuff which was in the existing Jensen course for professional practice, that was turfed out. And profession should teach it, says David Saunders. The profession took 2 years to decide, but we don't have the capacity to teach it. You've got to teach it. And if you don't teach it, we're going to take your recognition from you. And so David Saunders was faced with this awful problem of having to call back students who had already graduated to do professional practice courses in order to get a supplementary qualification where the University of Adelaide degree that they had obtained was going to satisfy the registration board. So that was a mess again to be sorted out. And so we now had to squeeze the professional practice into this 3-year course. But then the next pressure was that we are the only 6-year architecture course in Australia. The university is only funded for 5 years. You've got to reduce your course from 6 years to 5 years. And the only way you could do that was to shift the first year of the professional course into the third year of the first degree in some way, shape or form.
Oh, yes, yes.
Which destroyed the concept of the first degree.
Yep.
Now, let me take a moment to say something about the first degree, which even the University School of Architecture doesn't seem to appreciate. Certainly at the time when the two-degree structure was introduced, the career officers at secondary schools didn't really understand what we were doing or why we were doing it or what it was all about, even though we tried to get through to them. Consider the David Saunders course. In the first year of 4 subjects, second year 3 subjects, third year of 2 subjects, you had to do one of your first year subjects outside the faculty. That was us demanding that our students be exposed to another part of the university rather than this sort of closed shop of the School of Architecture. Secondly, you could do half your course in the first year, second year and third year outside the faculty, with the compulsory courses in the other half. And so that was what David Saunders wanted to encourage. So we had students who began to nibble towards taking this stuff. Whilst they could also take stuff in the school, like they could do the core half, they could take architectural history in the school, they could take art history and appreciation in the school, they could do other things in the school, like building science or building construction. We were trying to encourage them to take subjects in addition to the core subjects outside the faculty. We had some who experimented with architectural studies, Japanese, architectural studies, psychology, architectural studies, economics, architectural studies, commerce. The most interesting one, from my point of view, was a fellow who took architectural studies, geology. And he took my strand of building science. And at the end of second year, I had an outside lecturer who came in to lecture about graffiti and the removal of graffiti from stonework or concrete work or brickwork. And he said, look, I'm looking for somebody to come and assist me during the coming vacation. We've got this new product that helps to remove stuff. Have you got anybody? So I pushed this architectural studies geology student towards him, and he worked with this company. And that company actually kept him. And even when he graduated after his first degree, they had him for 5 years because of his geology knowledge. And he suddenly decided to up sticks, and he shifted from Adelaide to Sydney. He set up a business in Sydney, and he is the number one advisor on the selection of building stones for new buildings in Sydney, which is exactly what the David Saunders course was all about. But let's take that concept just a step further, which people don't do, even in the university. This was such a wonderful course that the individual could design their own course. Design their own course. The concept of the person that's going to enroll in the course, the person that's going to pay the money with international students, actually designing their own course, designing their own career, designing their own future. In a world where security of tenure of a job is no longer sure, where the only way to go is to create a special niche for yourself, for your own career, this course was so avant-garde that it's bypassed people's thought processes that they could do this. But that fellow who took the geology was an illustration of how it would work, where society would be provided with entirely new types of people. I mean, if you think about it, the change which has occurred over the last 30, 40 years of mixed degrees as the only way to go forward. It's certainly happened in the science faculties, in the engineering faculties. But in those days, we're going back 35 years. In those days, are we? 30 years. This was outstanding forward thinking of the way in which a university, not a technical college, a university would provide society with new kinds of talent, new kinds of people for tomorrow's problems, not today's problems, not yesterday's problem, but tomorrow's problems. And individuals could design their own course.
It's interesting, Derek, to think that in a sense, you were opposed to it in the first instance.
Absolutely. Because it was the destruction of the beliefs that I personally had with the Jensen course. Which only after David Saunders had... He's only lived 8 years. Sad.
Yes, yeah, very.
After David Saunders had died, and we get the appointment of Tony Radford. That's an interesting story in itself. I don't want to get too far down the track, Sometime I want to talk about students, but let's talk about the Radford thing. Now, when David Sanders died, I think everybody had, so far as they were able to, had reasonably settled into their into this new course. We'd each been given new roles, new duties, new responsibilities, and we'd either accepted them or not. For example, Zig Capellas had been given the opportunity of developing a course in first year called Visual Communication. And Zig had done his best in that, but it hadn't really caught on academically, so to speak. And Zig much preferred to be in a studio anyway. And so that course faded out of the choices. There were other things, that building construction was there, and that faded out. And it got subsumed into the core subjects. Building science faded out. That got subsumed into the core subjects. The third year of the original Bachelor of Architectural Studies course of David Sanders, the core subject was one half of the year's work. And as David Sanders saw it, this was the pulling together of everything in a global sense, not a house sense or an office building sense, a global sense. And the first year that David Sanders took that course to demonstrate to himself and to others of what he wanted to do, he took these Bachelor of Architectural Studies students up to Lee Creek. And he had all the experts of government that were involved in Lee Creek giving talks and lectures to the students, so that the students would have an idea of everything that was involved in the design, planning, and use of a new town like that. So he's trying to do the big picture. Subsequent staff who were allocated that responsibility, they couldn't handle it. They didn't have the breadth of knowledge and understanding that David Sanders... A big surprise to me, because he's an architectural historian.
Yeah.
Interested in art, interested in heritage. But he was able to handle this urban planning stuff, this urban design stuff. It was rather good. So when Radford came, we had a choice of three or four different people. And I was dean at the time, and I went on leave. And I told Stefan Pagusa, who took over from me, that's the person we want, not the others. And in my view, he was able to get Tony Radford. Why did I and Stefan think that he was the guy we wanted and not the other applicants, who were quite talented people, I must say? I'll tell you who they were, if you're interested.
Well, I think I know.
Judith Bryan.
Yes.
Who was also up at the same time for the chair in Perth and the chair in Canberra, and she eventually made the choice of the chair in Canberra. She didn't get the Adelaide one, which she wanted. Rob Cheeseman.
Yes.
And Boris Kazansky.
Yes.
Very good competition, but Tony Radford was different, in my view. And I have no regrets in saying to the council that that was the guy that I thought we wanted. Jensen, for all his time, had wanted to get computers into architecture, but he hadn't got very far. David Sanders wasn't into that at all, and individuals might have had Hollerith punch card technology with Wang computers, like Brian Atkinson and Deborah White, but when Tony came, we actually had a fellow with a doctorate in computing science, having come through the leading School of Architectural Science with Giro, who subsequently took over from Professor Cowan. He took over from Professor Cowan when Cowan retired, as a lead in the architecture and design science field in computing. And we had a product at that School of Architecture with a background in architecture and planning from Edinburgh and Newcastle, I think. And the world was moving into computers. And so David Sanders was appointed, and I think we were all rather pleased when he said, I'm very satisfied with the existing course. I don't want to change it. I'm going to change it bit by bit. And I think we all breathed a sigh of relief. We didn't want to go through all this business again. The thing about Tony Radford is that, I think I should tell you, two or three years ago, no, let's go back, about 1986, when Judith Bryan was head of department between the two professors, the school was asked to, the department was asked to be reviewed. And so Judith Bryan apparently argued that instead of having an external review, we could do our own internal review.
Yes.
And there is a document.
Yes,
that,
I know.
That deals with that. And I thought that was a pretty good document when it was finally completed. And so we did our own review, and that satisfied the university. And there hasn't been a review since, as far as I know. Can't remember one anyway.
I think so. I think there may have been, but anyway, that's all right.
I don't remember. But anyway, two or three years ago, the university decided to have an external review of the School of Architecture, and they got this fellow from Queensland to chair the meeting. They got a professor of architecture from MIT, and they got a professor of landscape architecture, a woman from Monash University. But the professor from Queensland, I'd met him, Kenniger, I think his name was. I'd met him when he was a lecturer, when I was a head of school and meeting at the heads of school thing when we went to Brisbane for that. And he was just a wise guy, accepted by the locals. And in the interim, he'd not only become head of architecture in Queensland, he then become, would you believe, Dean of the Faculty of Architecture and Engineering. And he was not accepted by a number of the engineers. What do you know about my field of engineering? And so apparently he had a meeting with the nano electrical engineers to try and convince them that he knew enough to be able to act as the dean of their work as well as anybody else's work. And he was able to convince them that the word architecture also applied to the architecture of nanotechnology. And so he got him on side. Well, in my view, he's just a big head. And he came in for 3 days with these two other professors, and they ransacked the school, as you can in 3 days, and pick up bugger all, as you can in 3 days. And I attended a meeting which they had called for the professions in the evening the day before they were going to present their report. The meeting was attended mostly by landscape architects who were concerned, and quite rightly, by the terrible landscape architecture course. Terrible, because it didn't have the staff. Mm. Stay simple, no staff. It's the town planning story all over again. And one or two senior architects, including David Parkin, who's now the CEO for the RAIA. I should say AIA now. And this fellow, Kenniger, he lambasted Tony Radford publicly. Tony wasn't there. And I thought, that's terrible. So that night, I came home, I spoke to Doris. I said, look, I'm going to have to ring Tony. I can't have him going into the public meeting tomorrow and not being forewarned that this bastard is going to crucify him publicly for the way in which Tony Radford runs the school. He hasn't a clue. So I rang Tony and I warned him, and as best you can, tell somebody that they're going to be crucified. It's not an easy thing to do, but because I have respect for somebody like David, I thought it's the only honest thing to do. And he was crucified. And why am I going on like this? And the thing is that that Tony Radford is a completely different kind of person. He runs the school differently from other people. Yes, he has the title of Professor of Architecture, but his name is not Jensen. His name is not Sanders. His name is Radford. And he doesn't sit on the top of the pyramid and, like Jensen, send down the tablets of stone as to how that you shall run the world. Tony Radford runs the department from behind. If a staff member like Susan Caldicott has an idea, he listens, he hears, and he encourages, and he supports, and they go for it. And what Susan Caldicott did for the staff was she got to know about something that was going on at the University of Newcastle in New South Wales. The University of Newcastle School of Architecture in New South Wales had a new professor there, I forget his name, and they had decided that the medical faculty had a model of teaching which could be applied sensibly in architecture. And the model that the medical faculty in University of New South Wales had was of projects. And so the way in which the medical students learned was through case histories, case studies. That, when applied in the Newcastle School of Architecture by a fellow named Cowdrey and one or two others, was what Susan Caldicott latched onto. She brought that into the school. Tony encouraged that to go forward. And the whole of this old Bachelor of Architectural Studies course was now recast into a Bachelor of Design Studies using this work of case studies and projects and problem solving. And that's what this Radford School of Architecture was now doing and pioneering 15, 20 years ago. 15 years ago, anyway. And 20 years ago. And that was its contribution. It was a leader in problem-solving, teaching in architecture. And yet, two or three years ago, the school gets clobbered. I made one protest comment at the meeting when we had a chance to speak. I said, how do you square the fact that this School of Architecture, only 2 years ago, was awarded a prize of $25,000 as being the best department in the university, as assessed by the university? That doesn't square with what you're saying. Oh, that doesn't count. Just brushed off as unimportant. So, when the report came through from this mob, these three, maybe mainly Kenninger, we have a situation of, I think, 43 things that are wrong with the school. And I, as a visiting research fellow, can attend, but have chosen not to. But now I did decide I'm going to sit in on the department meetings dealing with the treatment of this report. And the leadership of Tony Radford in dealing with this devastation of, external devastation of the school that he had created, and which wasn't his problem. He worked the oracle beautifully. nobody was prepared to take on the headship of the School of Architecture. David Jones, as the head of school and dean of faculty, had collapsed under the load. You can't teach a landscape architecture course of his academic standard, and David Jones is very good, and do the deanship and do the head of department. It's a two-person job, it's not a one-person job. I tried to tell David Sanders that, he collapsed. It's a two-person job, not a one-person job. I don't know how the hell Nancy's going to survive, how long she'll survive, but it's too much, in my view. But anyway, they brought in Kowalski. Wonderful choice, wonderful man, and he held the school together.
Kowalik,
yes. Yeah. Until Nancy was appointed, and Nancy arrived, as you know, beginning of last year. That was step number one, getting a second chair in the department. That was the recommendation number one. Recommendation number two, if you read this report, you probably got it, have you? Bring in skilled external designers. There's a little background, bit of background here, and that is that in a university school of architecture, where the order of the day is research, 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 and teaching takes second place, that doesn't fit with a school of architecture where studio work is the dominant element of an architectural, professional architect's graduate to become a practicing architect. You can't teach it by lectures. You only teach it by the act of doing studio work, design. Academic staff cannot get promotion by being design staff. They can only get promotion by being academic staff, which is a different kind of person. We tried for a time to work the Oracle the same way the music faculty does, with performance staff, trumpet players, flute players, harpists, you name it. How do they satisfy the academic mold? And we tried to get design into that kind of category. Very, very difficult. You produce a set of drawings or something, but it's more than that. How can you judge music when it's written on a piece of paper? You judge music unless you're sort of analyzing ancient scripts. It goes through the ear, it's feelings. Design's the same thing, it's feelings, it's emotion. That's what you're talking about. So, I don't think we succeeded in getting design staff recognized as designers. So, they stayed on the architectural history side, they stayed on the Islamic architecture side, they stayed in the engineering building science side. They didn't do it, they didn't operate. So the school is devoid, short of highly skilled design staff, performers, if you like. And they're all competent, but they're not highly skilled. Nancy, surprise, surprise, don't know how it happened, she bumped into Hadjis bin Kasturi, a student that I taught way back in 1958. And Kasturi stayed in the School of Architecture for 4 years, along with another lady, Ling Su Mei, who married Mr. Ong, Senior, who subsequently became the president of Singapore and died.
Yep.
And his younger brother, also an Ong.
Yep.
I can't remember his name, but I think he's also died. Ling Su Mei stayed. But Kasturi and a group of Malaysian students, they left the school and they went to Melbourne and they graduated in Melbourne. Nancy found out about him, and actually visited Malaysia, and she brought him back, and she got him a doctorate, she got him an appointment as a visiting professor, and this is the second of the Kenninger recommendations: bring in talented staff. Personally, and I don't want to denigrate Kasturi, but I don't think his architecture holds together in my terms. It's artistic architecture, which is not my forte. It's not my beliefs. I mean, at the time when the Sydney Opera House succeeded in capturing the world's attention, I am saying it's the biggest disaster for architectural education that it could possibly have been. Why? Because when you cut the cake, the building science application is a distortion of the correct application of building science. What do I mean by that? Building science can enable an architect to build an igloo, an ice igloo, in the tropics and make it work. That's the misuse of science and engineering. Complete misuse. Just because you can do it doesn't mean it's right. It's wrong to do that. I'm not talking in terms of energy conservation and sustainability and all that stuff. I'm just talking about the basic principles. The stuff should be applied properly and correctly. And the Sydney Opera House is a disaster. In that wonderful imagination, wonderful piece of sculpture for that site. That's only a part of architecture. It's the blending of all of that with the science and the acoustics and so on. It's just a hodgepodge. And I'm not saying that Kasturi's architecture is like that, but I'm just saying it doesn't move along the direction that I've always thought. I've never got anywhere with it, but because it's too difficult a concept for most architects to handle. Most, not all, most. So, where was I?
You were at the second part of Kenninger's.
Oh, yeah, I forget what the third one was.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think that in the Radford period, you have this person who's completely different, works from behind. Nancy is more, works from the top, the older fashioned. I've spoken to Tony, and he's very happy with Nancy as a colleague, and that's good. And I'm sure that the school will benefit from having a dual head, as it were. And I think that for the time being, at least, we've got a few more extra staff. When I retired 15 years ago, the student to staff ratio was 11 to 1. It's 18 or 19 to 1 now. When I retired, we had 16 or 17 full-time staff. They have 8 or 9 or 10 now. When I retired, the school was about 300 students. They're proposing to move to about 420, 450. I think the life of a staff member today is appalling in relation to what it should be for a university. And with the demands not just on teaching, but on research performance and on professional performance. Very difficult.
Now, Derek, before I have to go, would you like to talk about students, please? Because we've
oh, yes.
They've come in and out of your talk the whole time,
okay,
of
okay,
course.
Okay. Students have changed over the years. Earlier, when I was speaking about Bohemia, I got it wrong. It was Hobohemia. The students of those days seemed to have more time for other activities other than their academic studies. And I think that that broadened the quality of the product that the university put out. I've heard stories about University of Cambridge from a colleague of mine, Professor Tom Bell, who was a senior lecturer in chemistry here. He became a professor at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia. when he was at Cambridge, he joined the Mountaineers Club.
Mm.
And before you were accepted in the Mountaineers Club, you were given a map of Cambridge, and you had to climb your way from this building onto that building, down those drain pipes, up those drain pipes, across that bridge, down that, before you were allowed into the Mountaineers Club. That's the immediate post-war student, reminiscent of the pre-World War II students and behaviour, particularly of these number one, two universities in Britain. Now, in the University of Adelaide, in the School of Architecture, there was quite a bit of that quality of university education, well, of university life, that was going on underground that we as staff were not supposed to know about. I told you how we had moved from the mechanical, we started in the mechanical engineering building, southern end, second floor. We moved to the second floor of the civil engineering west end.
Yep.
We then moved as well to the east end of the civil engineering building and vacated the mechanical engineering building. We then moved across a bridge into the Horace Lamb building.
Yes.
And we vacated the eastern end first, which is the staff and general office, and then we vacated the western end and finally occupied the architecture building in that building. When we were occupying the second floor of the civil engineering building, and I think everybody would be horrified to learn this, there was a test that students had to do if they wanted to be part of the club. And that was to go out of the window onto the cornice and navigate the whole of the cornice around the whole of the civil engineering building down to Frome Road and back into the building. That's an activity which is reminiscent of the Mountaineering Club in the University of Cambridge, for any other reason than daredevils. There is a story of a complaint levelled by the professor of chemical engineering who lived at the eastern end of the building on the lower floors, of architecture students. Apparently, he'd get out of his car and he was chatting with somebody before he went into the building when a Coke bottle dropped from the cornice and landed nearby, and that was reported to the University Council. And Jensen was up before the Vice Chancellor, and as a result of that, the studio hours were restricted. It was difficult enough to gain the studio hours in the first place in the university setting. As I said earlier, they never understood the concept of studio work.
Yep.
But now we were told by Jensen that we had to have one night a week and weekend duties in the studio to ensure that supervised students were on the campus so they wouldn't drop Coke bottles on professors of chemical engineering. Okay, another story about the students of this time, of the early days, that very first cohort of students that went through, and you get more of this from Stefan Bagusa, no doubt, was the golf course. After time, instead of having the Jensen benches and stools, the way they were neatly arranged in rows, the students were given freedom to arrange the studio the way they wanted to arrange it as a group. And so you could actually put one table on top of a table, and a table on top of tables. And so students were designing their own spaces within the studio. Well, that then led to the golf course. So in the early hours of the morning, come on, it's time for golf, fellas. And the studio would then be converted into a golf course. You know, down on the old Woodville Road, they had one of these comic puzzle golf courses.
Yes,
well, this was a kind of three-dimensional, not a two-dimensional one, a three-dimensional golf course that you could navigate with pipes and tubes and holes and pitching up onto tabletops and so on. That, to me, demonstrates a student vitality, a creativity, which ought to be a part of student life today. I don't think it is. Everything's too hygienic. Safety, health and welfare. Everything's too neat and too insurance concerned and so on. The students, I went back to teach in 19... Well, let's put it this way. They gave me a visiting research fellowship, which is renewable every 2 or 3 years, depending on the... And they have done, so... 15 years since I retired. But they found it difficult to find somebody to teach surveying, land surveying and building surveying. And because I've taught it, they rang me up and said, would you mind coming back and teaching surveying? Well, I have to say, I have never qualified to teach surveying. Never. What happened to me was that this external professor who visited the University of Manchester when I was graduating and saw my drawings and chose me for his School of Architecture also saw my marks for surveying. And I got 98% for surveying. Why? Because I was just methodical and meticulous. So he told me I had to teach surveying when I was up in Glasgow. And that was on my CV when I came here. And he said, you've got to teach surveying here. And so it dogged me all my life. But the kind of surveying that I might have been trained as a municipal engineer in surveying, because of the Department of Municipal Engineering in Manchester. But the kind of surveying that I teach is not that which is in the civil engineering surveying textbooks. It's a surveying for practicing architects. And when in South Australia it was decided that you had to be qualified to do land surveying, and any land surveying had to be signed off by a land surveyor, that it became more important to teach architects the needs of architects for surveying, which is to get a rough approximation of a site so that you can do a sketch design on it, get the contract to do the job, then you employ the qualified person and get a proper survey done with all the details. So it doesn't matter if the half an inch error or even 2 inches error in levels or anything like that, as long as you've got a rough idea of what's happening. So it's how to do that kind of surveying, how to take photographs, what you need to photograph, what information you can take from the site back to the drawing office so you can do your designs. So they called me back to do that. And I think, just to finish off, when I meet these students who, of course, have never seen this old codger with grey hair and a rounded back who's getting on in years, they don't know what to expect. And I might start off something like this. Yes, I know what you're expecting. You're expecting the latest computer-oriented surveying lectures, and you're not going to get them from me. I'm old, I'm decrepit, and what I know is old-fashioned stuff. Of course, you want the modern stuff. I can't teach you the modern stuff. You just stick the tripod on the ground and the instrument levels itself. It almost takes the readings for you. You don't need teaching how to use that. You need teaching the basic principles of the subject. That's what I'm going to give you. Oh, I'm going to make a promise to you. You're actually going to be able to write it on your CV when you finish with my course, that you can actually do a little bit of surveying. It might get you a job. Yeah. And what equipment are we going to use? Very old-fashioned equipment. Even decrepit equipment. Oh. Why are you going to teach us that? Well, when you get your first job, and you're in the architect's office, and the architect says to you, go to the surveying store and get the equipment out, we're going surveying on the site today, and you open the cupboard, you'll find it's all this old-fashioned, old, decrepit stuff. Why? Because architects are not rich people, and this is second-hand stuff they picked up, and it's all old stuff. But at least you'll know what surveying's about when you finish this course. And that's my sort of introduction. And the second thing that they find as a surprise is that I don't think they've ever been treated as roughly by anybody as they've been treated by me. Why roughly and why like that? Not that I hate them or anything like that. I got a job to do. I used to teach a course of 27 lectures a week and 27 3-hour practicals a week. I'm now squeezed into teaching landscape architects in 2 days so that on the third day they can go and survey 2 sites for their first design projects. And in the case of architects, I'm given 6 lectures and a couple of 2-hour time slots, and then they all file in a bus or 2 buses, and they go out to a site for their design project. And the 60 of them, the only way I know of teaching them is to be a bit military. Right, get the instruments, get in line, stand around, pay attention, stop bloody talking. You, big head, you know, they've never been treated like this before. But you've got to move them in the short, it takes 20 minutes to get the equipment into their hands. It takes them 10 minutes to get down to the site. You've got 2 hours. You've got an hour of time because you're going to take another half an hour to get all the stuff back again.
Mm.
So it looks like 2 hours on the timetable. It's only 1 hour in practice. And of course, the weather, that doesn't help. I gave it up in 1970, when I was 76, which was 5 years ago, because I found I couldn't walk uphill and downdale in Wellington boots in the middle of July in cold conditions, supervising students that could be anything from 100 to 150 meters away from you because you break up the site and each do a bit. It was all too hard physically.
Mm.
No, that's why I retired. But I'm still alive mentally.
Derek, I don't think there's any doubt about that.
You can come back again another time if you want some more.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Derek. That was wonderful. Thank you very much for giving your time.
That's okay.